Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Pat Livingston, and I'm ready to plunge into what is a truly fascinating cross-section of global anxiety and, well, market exuberance.
And I'm Chris Sinclair.
Today, we are undertaking a comprehensive analysis that we're calling Bloomberg Business Week for November 2025.
And we have a dense yet, incredibly insightful stack of sources today that I think captures the absolute duality of our current global moment.
That's exactly right. Our mission today is to, quickly and thoroughly extract the key trends and insights from this issue, focusing on what we're sort of labeling the feelings bubble.
The feelings bubble.
Yeah, this bizarre paradox where you have global markets just soaring, asset prices hitting all-time highs, and yet every headline from politics to trade to climate is screaming about this profound geopolitical and economic anxiety. We really need to figure out why the world feels so fundamentally unpredictable right now.
It is an urgent analysis because what the sources capture is this strange friction.
Mm-hmm.
We have to unpack the deep structural chaos in Washington, the proposed changes to how corporate America discloses its financial health, the total rewiring of global trade routes driven by protectionism, and of course, the massive scale of speculative spending that's fueling the AI boom. That underlying tension, I think, defines this entire deep dive.
Okay, let's get into it, and we'll start where the chaos feels most, well, intentional.
Yeah.
The political sphere. And we have to begin with California Governor Gavin Newsom, who is clearly trying to carve out a massive national role for himself.
Newsom is absolutely positioning himself as the primary Democratic counterweight to Donald Trump. It's specifically designed to appeal to the national media apparatus. The source material describes his adopted strategy as obscenity-laced political pugilism.
Political pugilism.
Exactly. He's trying to meet the aggressive media-saturated tactics of Trump with his own version of fighting words and, rapid response content production. He's effectively trying to lead what many in the party establishment see as a listless Democratic Party that's searching for a future champion.
He's definitely seeking confrontation, but I have to ask, given the history of political tactics failing against Trump, is this pugilism truly a viable long-term strategy, or is it just, generating clicks and attention in the short term?
I think it's dual purpose. It generates the attention, but his immediate concrete focus is actually local with massive national implications. Right now, Newsom is hyper-focused on the November 4 redistricting referendum in California, which is known as Proposition 50. This is the key battleground.
And the stakes here are absolutely critical for the Democrats nationwide.
They couldn't be higher. If Prop 50 passes, it solidifies California Democrats' control over their state legislative and congressional maps. And crucially, Newsom believes this victory will create a template, a blueprint, for Democrats in other states to overcome Trump's efforts to gerrymander midterm elections in favor of Republicans across the country.
So it's bigger than California.
Much bigger. He calls this particular effort his rocking chair test.
His rocking chair test.
Right.
Something he can look back on.
Exactly. It's a measure of whether his efforts to solidify Democratic political power will ultimately succeed and be something he can look back on with pride years from now.
That is a high-stakes, multi-front play. And it really forces him to walk a tightrope, showcasing the duality inherent in running a hyper-progressive state that is also the world's fifth-largest economy.
It is.
On one hand, he's pushing very progressive goals. Expansive gun control, protecting abortion access, supporting unionization for gig workers at giants like Uber and Lyft. These are core Democratic demands.
But on the other hand, he absolutely has to protect the golden goose of prosperity. And that means keeping Silicon Valley and Hollywood happy. The state's progressive tax structure, which is fueled by soaring tech stock valuations and high earner incomes, it stuffed California's coffers to the tune of over $170 billion in budget surpluses during the pandemic years.
So he needs to satisfy the progressive electorate without driving away the hyper-wealthy tech and entertainment leaders whose capital generates the bulk of the state's operating revenue.
Right. If they leave, the state budget collapses. It's that simple.
And the culture war is central to his strategy because he realizes the Democrats are losing the online battle. This is where the source provides that just fascinating anecdote about his personal moment of realization.
Yeah, he was shocked when he was preparing to launch his own podcast, and he mentioned his potential first guest, the conservative influencer Charlie Kirk, to his 14-year-old son, Hunter. Hunter was already familiar with Kirk, which was jarring enough for Newsom, but then Hunter was more infatuated with Andrew Tate, the right-wing influencer notorious for his misogynistic content. Newsom recounted that his son asked why he wasn't meeting with Tate, insisting that Tate was innocent.
Wow. in his own home.
Yeah.
That moment underscores a massive political problem. For a seasoned Democrat, seeing that rightward shift manifesting right there through figures like Tate shows how the digital landscape, TikTok, YouTube, social media, has been shifting significantly away from established Democratic messaging and towards provocative right-wing content.
And that realization is what drives Newsom's aggressive response. He's trying to reverse engineer a way to engage with and counter this new media universe.
And it also explains his tactical moderation, right, to combat what he calls California derangement syndrome.
Exactly, that Republican tendency to unfairly characterize the state as a progressive dystopia. So he's adopted noticeably moderate stances to try and undercut those attacks. For example, we've seen him fast-track approval for thousands of new oil wells after oil and gas companies began shutting down domestic production, aiming to stabilize energy markets and reduce gas prices.
And he also froze healthcare enrollments for undocumented adults, which, you know, shocked many of his progressive allies. He is constantly signaling that he is a pragmatic progressive who understands economic reality while still trying to uphold core democratic values.
Whether this tightrope walk will succeed in the national arena, where voters in the middle of the country might view him purely through that lens of California derangement, well, that's the central question of his political future. But he is betting that his aggressive, attention-grabbing style, coupled with a Prop 50 victory, will cement his place as the natural successor for the party.
That's a perfect pivot point. From Newsom's attempt to influence the political apparatus, let's look at the financial architecture that underlies corporate governance. Specifically, this contentious debate over mandatory quarterly earnings reports.
This is a huge, I mean, a truly fundamental change being proposed. SEC Chairman Paul Atkins recently proposed scrapping mandatory quarterly reporting, requiring public companies to disclose their financials only twice a year. And as you can imagine, businesses led by powerful lobbies like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce are ecstatic. They argue the current system is an onerous time sink.
The cost argument is certainly tangible. Research from Audit Analytics highlights that the average annual fee businesses pay external auditors for these four reviews a year is over $2 million.
It is.
For a mid-sized company, that is a substantial recurring expense.
But the more profound philosophical argument against quarterly reporting is that it forces a short-term obsession, the infamous earnings theater. We can trace the intensity of this pressure back to leaders like Jack Welch at General Electric, who notoriously prioritized meeting Wall Street estimates for an astonishing 80 consecutive quarters.
80 quarters.
80. He turned disclosure into a public spectacle where failure was just not an option.
And that relentless pursuit of the quarterly target often came at the expense of sound long-term strategy. And we have the data to prove it. The 2004 Duke University survey of CFOs remains just damning. 78% of CFOs admitted sacrificing genuine shareholder value just to hit those short-term targets and prevent a stock dip.
And that sacrifice wasn't theoretical. The study detailed how executives would delay critical, high-value expenditures. They'd slash research and development budgets, postpone promising new infrastructure projects, or arbitrarily cut advertising campaigns vital for long-term brand building. All just to ensure the current quarter's profit number matched analyst expectations.
It's just incredible.
Campbell Harvey, one of the economists involved, noted that every single CFO he interviewed confirmed this behavior. It's a deep structural incentive problem that forces companies to manage the stock price rather than manage the business.
Okay, so if the quarterly system is so destructive to long-term value creation, why isn't the move to semi-annual reporting universally embraced?
Because removing frequent disclosure creates a different and perhaps more insidious set of problems. Experts argue that shifting to semi-annual reports increases stock volatility dramatically. When you create a six-month information vacuum, the market reacts violently to any small piece of news or rumor. Investors hate informational scarcity, and this vacuum benefits the already powerful.
You mean it benefits sophisticated investors?
Precisely.
How exactly do they capitalize on the lack of public information?
They are the investors who can afford advanced, non-traditional data sources that fill that six-month void the rest of the market relies on. We're talking about firms paying millions for satellite images of retail parking lots to gauge foot traffic, or using AI to track hiring patterns or analyzing shipping manifestos. They gain an immediate, quantifiable informational edge that is simply unavailable to the average person.
So the U.S. market, which accounts for half the global market value, partly because of the trust frequent disclosure inspires, becomes less fair.
Correct. Studies strongly suggest that moving to semi-annual reporting increases the risk of insider trading. It tilts the playing field heavily toward those with deep pockets and advanced data access. It's a profound catch-22. Quarterly reporting distorts management decisions, but semi-annual reporting risks introducing opacity and unfairness. And it's worth noting that even Jack Welch, the king of quarterly earnings theater, later admitted to the Financial Times that focusing solely on shareholder value was the dumbest idea in the world.
That's the irony of structural change, isn't it? It always introduces new, unintended consequences. Now, let's shift back to the political drivers of our anxiety and look at the chaos emanating directly from the administrative center. The Trump administration's approach to running the government.
The strategy is, well, chaos by design, often described as a plan to flood the zone. In the first 8 months of his second term, Trump signed an astonishing 205 executive orders.
205, that's an incredible number.
To give you context, President Ronald Reagan, known for his ambitious deregulation, signed only 35 in the same period of his second term. This sheer volume is meant to overwhelm the government bureaucracy, the courts, and the media, making it impossible to effectively track, staff, or legally challenge the sweeping changes.
But the consequences of this shock-and-awe approach, particularly after Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, implemented deep cuts, are starting to manifest as massive administrative disarray.
The purge of the civil service was rapid and brutal. Now, key federal agencies, the FAA, Department of Energy, IRS, USAID, they're all quietly trying to backfill approximately 17,000 jobs they realized they couldn't function without.
So they're just not able to do their jobs.
The consequences of these vacant positions are far-reaching. For example, the lack of IRS processing staff is slowing crucial tax enforcement and refund processes for regular citizens, not just high-profile political targets. The lack of FAA inspectors means safety certifications and new aviation technology approvals are grinding to a halt, creating backlogs that threaten the entire aviation sector. The government is simply unable to perform its basic functions.
And beyond the administrative meltdown, the policies themselves are often contradictory, creating a whipsaw effect for the key groups that Trump relies on for political support.
We have two incredible examples of these conflicting policies. First, immigration enforcement. Despite business owners, including those in the agricultural and manufacturing sectors, complaining bitterly about severe labor shortages, the administration intensified ICE raids.
Mm-hmm.
In a spectacular example of poor timing, ICE raided a Hyundai LG battery plant under construction in Georgia.
And they arrested South Korean engineers who actually had valid permits to work in the U.S. right after South Korea agreed to a massive $350 billion trade deal with the U.S.
Exactly.
That is more than an inconvenience. It's a major diplomatic incident stemming from internal contradictions.
Absolutely. The administration was forced to dispatch the Deputy Secretary of State to Seoul to offer an official expression of deep regret for the incident, recognizing the diplomatic and economic damage. The second example is with the loyal farming constituency. They consistently supported Trump, giving him an average of 78% of their county votes, but they are suffering both from labor shortages due to the immigration crackdown and from trade war retaliation.
We know China stopped buying U.S. soy meal entirely back in 2023. Agricultural exports to China fell 53% in the first 7 months of this year compared to the year before. While Trump promises tariff money bailouts, the farmers who are bracing for a little while of economic pain are realizing that the tariffs and the disruption to global markets are turning into a much longer-term threat.
The overarching insight here is that the political system, whether it's Newsom trying to engineer a national strategy or Trump deliberately engineering chaos, is contributing massively to the climate of unpredictability that defines our feelings bubble.
That unpredictable reality, especially driven by tariffs and protectionism, naturally leads us into our next section, how global trade is currently being reshaped and rerouted away from U.S. gravitational pull.
Despite the U.S. adopting aggressively protectionist policies, and we are talking about the highest U.S. tariffs imposed since the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of the 1930s, global commerce is showing surprising resilience.
So trade is actually above. Despite everything.
It is. The World Trade Organization actually raised its 2025 trade growth forecast from a modest mere 0.9% up to 2.4%. The world economy appears to be adapting, not collapsing, under America's trade barriers.
What's truly fascinating is that the trade isn't stopping. It's just actively rerouting, which means the global economic map is being drawn in real time.
It's being redrawn completely. China's exports to the U.S. plunged 33%, a devastating hit. But simultaneously, their exports to Southeast Asia rose almost 23%, and their exports to the African continent climbed 26%.
This is forcing the formation of major new alliances that bypass the U.S. entirely.
That's right. European countries, recognizing the instability of relying on U.S. trade policy, are fast-tracking massive trade pacts, including the one with Mercosur, the common market of South American countries, a deal that has been in negotiation for 25 years. They also recently inked a free trade agreement with Indonesia and jump-started talks with Australia. The rest of the world is building a network where the U.S. is no longer the indispensable center.
This shift away from rules-based global systems like the World Trade Organization towards these bilateral or regional deals raises major alarm bells for smaller developing nations.
It absolutely does. Cornell economist Eswar Prasad warns that this move makes the world much harsher for small economies. He cites Timor-Leste, one of the newest WTO members, with a population of only 1.4 million. Nations like this rely entirely on the WTO's standardized, rules-based system to diversify their economies and find markets for niche goods like high-end coffee and vanilla.
In a world of giants making their own deals, they get left behind.
In a world defined by exclusive bilateral deals between giants, these small players lose their anchor and find themselves politically and economically marginalized.
And the ultimate irony is that the trade war designed to protect U.S. companies is now harming U.S. companies. We have the example of True Places, a Pennsylvania-based company that designs high-end outdoor chairs manufactured in Cambodia.
Because of the steep tariffs the U.S. placed on these imported components and goods, True Places is now considering not operating or selling in the U.S. at all, as the tariffs make their domestic business model completely unviable. They are actively scouting for customers overseas, essentially being forced to become foreign exporters just to stay afloat.
So the protectionism is pushing a U.S. company out of the U.S. market.
Exactly. The protectionism designed to boost domestic manufacturing is pushing a U.S. designer to flee its home market.
This leads us directly to the severe and immediate impact of these tariffs in India's textile sector.
This is a devastating geopolitical consequence. The U.S. slapped a 50% tariff on Indian imports, the highest rate imposed on any Asian country, as direct punishment for India's continued purchasing of discounted Russian crude oil. This has severely disrupted India's massive $174 billion textile sector, which is a backbone of the country, employing over 45 million people.
And the human cost is concentrated in places like Tirupur, India's knitwear capital, where manufacturers had invested heavily based on optimism about stable U.S.-India trade relations.
Take R.K. Sivasubramaniam, who manages Raft Garments. He secured a $2 million bank loan to buy new, modern machinery. When the 50% tariff hit in late August, his U.S. buyers immediately demanded a 16% discount, a concession that would prevent him from even breaking even on the order.
But he refused.
He refused, and now he's saddled with debt and $1.5 million worth of unsold inventory.
Just sitting on $1.5 million worth of underwear.
Specifically, basic undergarments destined for the U.S. market. He's now desperately searching for buyers in Europe and domestically, worrying deeply about paying salaries and the customary Diwali bonuses for his workers, who are often internal migrants relying on these funds to support families back home.
And this isn't an isolated problem.
The financial exposure is systemic, not isolated. Following the pandemic, manufacturers across India were encouraged to add capacity to diversify global supply chains away from China, leading to a huge wave of debt-funded capital investments. Gross outstanding bank credit to the Indian textile sector hit a record high of $31.6 billion in June. These tariffs could shave 0.9% off India's GDP, instantly destabilizing Prime Minister Modi's ambitious agenda to boost domestic manufacturing and threatening a financial collapse within the sector.
While the U.S. is busy using tariffs to disrupt trade, China has been strategically building the physical infrastructure of global commerce.
Yeah.
Its massive global port empire.
This network is a long-term geopolitical play, and the scale is just staggering. Chinese firms now own or operate terminals at over 90 deepwater ports overseas, including 34 of the top 100 busiest ports globally, and interests in over a third of all commercial ports in Africa. President Xi Jinping's stated vision is that to get rich, we must first build ports. This isn't just commercial. It is a profound strategic leverage point.
This immediately raises profound geopolitical implications, especially at critical choke points like the Panama Canal.
Absolutely. Trump has demanded that Panama revoke the rights of C.K. Hutchison Holding Ltd. to operate the two gateways to the canal. The U.S. military's concern is that Beijing's influence could allow it to strategically slow down U.S. naval deployments to Asia in a crisis, for instance, in the event of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, which could add anywhere from 10 to 22 days to the journey from the Atlantic fleet.
And we're seeing the strategy everywhere.
Everywhere. Costco Shipping Corp, which the Pentagon blacklisted for links to the People's Liberation Army, owns interests in key ports like Piraeus in Greece, a vital gateway to Europe, and the massive new Chancay port in Peru, which is set to become a primary gateway to South America.
The threat extends even to key U.S. allies. Australia is working to reclaim its strategic Darwin port, which was leased to the Landbridge Group for 99 years, due to fears that Beijing could use it for intelligence gathering during U.S. and Japan military drills hosted there.
The consensus among strategic analysts is that this port network is already too entrenched and comprehensive for the U.S. to counter effectively through simple regulation or diplomatic pressure. It provides China with critical commercial advantages, vast data collection capabilities, and undeniable global leverage.
Wait. If the U.S. is this alarmed about the Panama Canal and the entrenchment across the globe, is there anything the U.S. government can actually do, short of military action or demanding allies choose a side, to counter this financial entrenchment?
Well, the options are limited and deeply complex. The U.S. can only try to pressure the host countries through aid or trade deals, which often fail when China offers quicker, cheaper infrastructure investment. The only real counter is competing on speed and price, and right now the U.S. investment in such infrastructure just doesn't match China's scale or timeline. It's a long game where China has already amassed substantial positional advantages.
It's easy to get bogged down in trade wars and geopolitical tension, so let's take a moment to look at the positive side of global entrepreneurship, the solutions-focused innovators emerging in this new economy.
Yeah, this section highlights the catalysts, people dedicated to solving tangible, real-world problems. For example, in Ghana, you have Yaw Bediako, who co-founded Yamachi Biotech. He noticed the critical lack of genetic diversity in clinical trials, which severely limits drug discovery effectiveness, so he created the African Cancer Atlas to aggregate and share that crucial genomic data.
And addressing the China dependency issue that came up with rare earth minerals, we have Yatindra Deshpande in the U.S. He co-founded Conifer, which is developing advanced electric motors that use non-rare earth magnets, specifically designed to reduce global dependence on Chinese-dominated supply chains for these crucial components.
Then there's Mira Mehta in Nigeria, who founded Tomato Joe's. Nigeria is a major tomato producer, but historically suffers from massive logistics deficits, lack of effective storage, processing facilities, transportation. Tomato Joe's aims to address these issues holistically, empowering local partner farmers and operating a state-of-the-art tomato paste plant since 2021, turning a volatile crop into a stable economic driver. These are tangible, solutions-focused efforts to build more equitable and sustainable global systems.
That brings us to our next major segment, the investment conundrum swirling around artificial intelligence and its profound impact on personal finance, which is truly fueling this feelings bubble. The central question everyone is asking, is the AI boom a bubble?
The scale of the spending is unprecedented, but so is the skepticism. Tech giants are spending an estimated $371 billion just this year on data centers.
Just this year.
McKinsey projects that by 2030, a total of $5.2 trillion will be needed in total capital spending to keep up with the projected demand for AI infrastructure.
Wait, $5 trillion?
$5.2 trillion. To put that in perspective, that's an infrastructure spend 7 times larger than the entire U.S. interstate highway system.
But the revenue projections, they don't seem to justify that colossal scale of investment.
They absolutely don't. AI technology is only expected to generate about $60 billion in revenue in 2025. Bain & Co. did the math and calculated that big tech needs $2 trillion in additional annual revenue by 2030 just to pay for the required expenditures. They project an $800 billion annual shortfall even under optimistic growth scenarios. The math simply doesn't add up yet.
The skeptics must be pointing to the hardware itself, arguing that unlike railroads, this infrastructure is temporary.
Exactly. Skeptics like Harris Kupperman of Praetorian Capital Management call it a bubble because of the unique nature of the hardware. Mm-hmm. Past infrastructure booms created lasting assets, but the essential chips for AI, the specialized GPUs, they depreciate quickly. They have a useful shelf life of only a few years before new technology makes them obsolete.
So it's a hamster wheel.
This means the investment feels less like a long-term asset and more like a never-ending hamster wheel of capital expenditure.
And even if you want to spend the money, there are immediate physical bottlenecks that complicate everything, especially energy supply.
That's critical. It takes 2 to 3 years just to construct a data center, but connecting it to sufficient energy sources can take as long as 8 years. The Commonwealth of Virginia, which is the data center capital of the world, has concluded that meeting the unconstrained energy needs of this infrastructure will be very difficult and require massive, decade-long overhauls of the electric grid. So even if the multi-trillion dollar budget is spent, it might take until the 2030s to generate the projected revenue.
And the concern over financial opacity must be fueling the bubble talk.
It does. Skeptics point to the growing opacity of funding mechanisms. Big startups are relying heavily on private credit firms and using complex, obscure, special-purpose vehicles that help keep the debt and massive capital expenditure off the main balance sheets of the major tech companies, obscuring the true extent of the industry's liabilities.
Okay, so what's the counterargument? Why are the AI bulls shrugging off this daunting math and the inherent obsolescence risk?
Well, they offer historical context and financial strength. They argue that, proportionally, the infrastructure spending isn't that large compared to historical bubbles. The railroad boom of the 19th century, for instance, was 4 times greater relative to the GDP of its era than current AI infrastructure spending.
I see.
Furthermore, they note that big tech companies have sufficient cash reserves. They can afford to lose a few hundred billion if the paradigm shifts. They aren't fragile startups.
And there's the futurist argument, too. George Gilder, who wrote glowingly about the fiber optic revolution right before that bubble burst, now dismisses the current data center frenzy entirely.
Yeah, Gilder argues that data centers are yesterday's technology. He believes the future lies in wafer-scale processors better suited for inference tasks, predicting that big tech has about 4 or 5 years to futz around with these data centers before the entire technological paradigm shifts again. So even the AI optimist camp is divided on the merits of the current massive data center gold rush.
This inherent tension between the massive economic optimism driven by this AI spending and the underlying financial fragility is exactly what defines our central theme. It forces the core question. How do you invest in the feelings bubble?
We have to acknowledge the investment reality. The stock market is soaring, reaching all-time highs. The Shiller P.E. ratio is near 40 times earnings.
For those unfamiliar with that term, could you just quickly explain what the Shiller P.E. is?
Of course. It's also known as the KPE, or cyclically adjusted price-to-earnings ratio. Unlike the standard P.E., the Shiller P.E. smooths out corporate earnings volatility by averaging them over the past 10 years, adjusted for inflation. This makes it a much better measure of long-term market valuation. Hitting 40 times earnings, as we saw during the 1999.com peak, signals massive market overvaluation. This reality high anxiety mixed with huge returns means standard buy and hold advice feels inadequate.
So the experts suggest, first and foremost, disciplined risk management, especially for those closer to retirement.
Yes. Christine Duns of Morningstar advises that investors over age 50 must be serious about fixed income and cash exposure. She suggests holding 30 to 40% of their assets in safer categories. The reason for this is to create a buffer. This cash reserve gives you the ability to fund 3 to 5 years of retirement expenses without being forced to sell stocks during a market downturn, insulating you from the Shiller PE risk.
And even if you're younger and have a longer horizon, the massive growth assumptions we've gotten used to are probably unsustainable.
That's critical. Investors need to run their long-term financial numbers, assuming Vanguard's sobering projections. Projected annual returns for U.S. equities have a bracingly slow 3.3% to 5.3% over the next decade. The market has had incredible tailwinds for years. That may change, and preparing for lower returns is the height of responsibility.
If you are looking to diversify outside of the U.S. tech giants, where are the opportunities?
International stocks are relatively cheap after years of lagging the U.S. market, and they have begun to make a comeback. For the bullish investor, look beyond the immediate big tech companies to future AI winners in R&D-heavy areas like healthcare, biotech, or small-cap stocks, which would benefit significantly from expected Fed rate cuts.
And for those who are more bearish, how do they hedge against the anxiety inherent in the feelings bubble?
They should also focus on diversification, specifically internationally, using indices like the MSCI ACWI.
Could you quickly explain what MSCI ACWI represents?
Certainly. MSCI ACWI stands for the Morgan Stanley Capital International All-Country World Index. It's a very broad global equity index that includes both developed and emerging markets. And right now, about 35% of its weighting is outside the U.S., giving you immediate geographic balance.
Got it.
For specific hedges, bearish investors should look at gold, which has been hitting records this year due to geopolitical risk and global infrastructure investments.
Wise. Specifically infrastructure.
Because assets like cell phone towers, electric grids, and railroads tend to have stable revenue streams and built-in contractual price increases, making them excellent defensive investments that perform well in high inflationary or uncertain economic environments.
Finally, we need to heed the warning about the wealth effect, which suggests the economy may be far more vulnerable than it appears.
Doug Ramsey of Luthol Group points out that strong consumer spending isn't broad. It's being fueled primarily by high asset prices. The top 10% of U.S. earners now account for almost 50% of all consumer spending, a record dating back to 1989.
50%.
This spending is often on luxury services, travel, and large asset purchases. This heavy linkage leaves the entire economy vulnerable. If stock prices tumble, that discretionary spending could evaporate quickly, triggering a deep recession.
And this brings us to a company that perfectly embodies the complexity and contradiction of this bubble moment, Robinhood.
Robinhood is the product of the meme stock craze and the push to democratize investing. The CEO, Vlad Tenev, is obsessed with staying relevant to Gen Z and millennials, capitalizing on its mobile-first, zero-fee reputation. Since Trump's election, Robinhood stock is up a stunning 504%, culminating in its inclusion in the prestigious S&P 500 index.
This incredible growth is happening even as the company faces a deep internal conflict. They are trying desperately to achieve legitimacy and attract older, more affluent assets.
They are attempting to transform into a serious, established financial institution. They've hired former SEC staff, they offer legitimate retirement portfolios, and they acquired registered investment advisors. But simultaneously, they are introducing high-risk, highly gamified products that deliberately blur the line between traditional investing and pure gambling.
Right, like sports betting via derivatives. You can now place wagers on everything from the Oscars to a WNBA game right next to your retirement account. Critics, including analysts at Vanguard, argue this reinforces the crowd-following behavior that ultimately erodes returns and caters to dopamine addiction, not long-term wealth creation. Isn't that fundamentally against their stated mission to democratize investing?
It creates enormous tension. Tenev frames it as an American company sitting at the intersection of capitalism and democracy. But the ultimate play is political and generational. Tenev is working closely with the Trump administration on the initiative for $1,000 tax-advantaged investment accounts for every newborn.
An attempt to build brand loyalty, starting with literal babies. That is a wild generational play.
It is the most extreme long-term strategy yet. Robinhood believes its best shot at capturing the next generation of investors is by being the default platform for these new tax-advantaged accounts from the very beginning of their lives. Tenev argues that traditional providers won't execute the initiative as quickly or effectively, potentially cementing Robinhood's place as the gateway for millions of new accounts. It's a masterclass in capitalizing on cultural shifts and political openings.
That's a powerful transition point. Let's pivot now to a segment that addresses health, climate, and how innovation is tackling long-standing societal problems, starting with a better, less invasive way to treat prostate cancer.
Prostate cancer treatment has historically been a medical failure characterized by extremes. For decades, the pendulum swung between over-screening using the PSA blood test, which often led to false positives, and aggressive sledgehammer over-treatment, usually involving surgery or radiation that attacked the entire gland.
And that aggressive approach resulted in catastrophic, permanent side effects that destroyed the quality of life for thousands of men.
Absolutely. Up to 40% of men who have their prostate removed suffer from long-term incontinence. As many as 70% experience erectile dysfunction, and almost 90% lose ejaculation capacity within 5 years. Dr. Hashim Ahmed, a leading urologist, calls this 2 or 3 decades of harm resulting from outdated practices.
Dr. Ahmed is now championing a revolution in treatment called focal therapy. How does this technique work?
Focal therapy uses high-intensity sound bursts delivered via a specialized probe inserted rectally to precisely cook the cancer. The energy destroys the cancerous tumor with pinpoint accuracy while sparing the surrounding tissue. This shifts the procedure from major surgery to a highly targeted ablation.
The difference in recovery and quality of life is startling.
It's night and day. Recovery is measured in weeks, not months or years. The risks of permanent side effects plummet. Less than a 1% risk of lasting leakage, about a 5% chance of erectile dysfunction, and only half of patients experience a complete loss of ejaculation. It's a paradigm shift aimed at maintaining a man's quality of life.
To match this smarter treatment, Ahmed is advocating for smarter screening.
Yes. He is running the Massive Transform trial, enrolling over 250,000 men to demonstrate that screening should shift away from blood-based PSA tests, which are highly inaccurate, to MRI-based screening. These MRI tests take only 10 minutes and can be conducted in mobile vans, providing a much more accurate and less invasive way to locate small, high-risk tumors early.
Yet, despite the promising results, focal therapy is still facing controversy within the medical establishment.
It remains classified as investigational in major medical guidelines. The main criticism is the risk inherent in partial treatment. The untreated portion of the prostate could still develop cancer, sometimes years later. However, centers that utilize it, like the Cleveland Clinic, emphasize that when patients are carefully selected based on MRI visibility and tumor size, the success rate is very high and the quality of life improvements are undeniable.
From treating the body, let's look at how we treat our feet after exercise. We have seen the unexpected lucrative rise of recovery footwear.
This represents a massive market shift that targets athletes outside the field of play. Companies are now targeting the après sport phase, the hours when serious runners and athletes are recovering, not competing. They're selling self-care for your feet after a grueling workout.
The pioneer in this space was Ufos, founded in 2011, which created the $70 Olala flip-flops using energy-absorbing foam.
Ufos' core selling point is maximum cushion foam that acts like a soft pillow, alleviating stress on joints and reducing impact. But Ufos is facing a formidable and unlikely competitor, Birkenstock.
Birkenstock.
Yes. While others push cushion, Birkenstock is taking the opposite tack, arguing that tired feet need firm support via their patented contoured footbed. They are appealing to the same serious crowd, runners, golfers, and outdoor enthusiasts.
And the counterintuitive strategy is working.
It is. Since Birkenstock started stocking their products and running specialty stores early last year, its sales have surged by over 60%, rapidly chipping away at UFO's market share and proving that recovery, as a distinct footwear category, is now a massive business.
That category, once a niche, is now getting very lucrative and competitive.
Very.
Moving from consumer trends to environmental and geopolitical risks, we turn to the controversial events in Dubai. The catastrophic April 2024 storm and the resulting cloud seeding accusations.
The storm was unprecedented. It caused $3 billion in damage and 4 confirmed deaths, flooding Dubai International Airport and leaving luxury cars submerged. Almost immediately, online speculation targeted the UAE's long-running cloud seeding program, the practice where specialized aircraft introduce salt-based particles into the atmosphere to encourage condensation and increase rainfall.
The official response only fueled the conspiracy theories. The National Center of Meteorology, or NCM, initially denied seeding that day, given the storm's power. Then a meteorologist confirmed 7 operations had taken place. Then the NCM changed its story again, claiming the planes were only taking samples.
Which is where the official story breaks down completely. Former NCM pilots revealed that the Beechcraft King airplanes used for seeding are only equipped to deliver flares and lack the specialized equipment required to take cloud samples.
So they couldn't have been taking samples.
They couldn't. One former pilot noted that he didn't know what upsets me more, the lying or the incompetent lying, pointing to a clear internal effort to control the narrative.
And these former NCM pilots revealed serious systemic safety issues within the program's management.
They reported a history of managers pressuring them to fly in extremely unsafe conditions, even threatening their jobs if they refused missions. The internal culture focused on box ticking, running up mission numbers for daily reports, rather than focusing on actual results or pilot safety. Pilots who raised alarms about potential flooding risk were repeatedly ignored by management.
When it comes to the science, there are conflicting views on whether seeding could cause a storm of this magnitude.
Some scientists argue that when condensation is already turning into rain so efficiently in a powerful storm, seeding has a minimal impact. It's like a breeze stopping an inner-city train going at full tilt. However, others found measurable connections between cloud seeding and increased urban flood risk.
And crucially, the NCM's own figures cite rainfall increases from 5 to 35% due to seeding.
And that margin is the key issue in an urban environment like Dubai, which has rapidly urbanized and paved over natural drainage areas. As one hydrological modeling expert put it, if 10% of a lot is a lot, that extra margin of rain is exactly what can overwhelm drainage systems that are already compromised by rapid urbanization and insufficient infrastructure planning.
It points directly to the geopolitical risk of geoengineering.
It does. Water is inherently political, as the president of the World Water Council noted. When multiple regional neighbors like Saudi Arabia and Oman are competing for the same airbound moisture, and the technology is powerful enough to be dangerous in the wrong hands, the stakes are monumental. This technology allows a state to claim a natural resource, rain, that was once accessible to all, risking cross-border conflict.
From the large-scale risks of climate modification, we move to high-end consumer finance and the fiercely competitive luxury credit card market.
This is a fierce, escalating rivalry between American Express and Chase, vying intensely for the wealthiest 10% of U.S. households. The competition just escalated dramatically, with Amex Platinum hiking its annual fee from $695 to $895, and Chase Sapphire Reserve jumping from $550 to $795. These are serious barriers to entry.
They're essentially turning the credit card into a country club in your wallet to justify these exorbitant fees.
Precisely. They compete through an arms race of exclusive lifestyle perks. Private dinners with famous chefs, exclusive concert access, free apparel from high-end brands like Lululemon, monthly Uber credits, and luxurious airport lounge access. The card is designed not just for transactions, but to be an undeniable status symbol that goes everywhere the affluent shopper goes.
But Chase has a distinct strategic advantage over Amex, which is fundamentally a credit card-only company.
That's right. Chase Sapphire Reserve serves as a powerful strategic front door to the entire bank. If Chase can capture these affluent consumers with the Reserve card, they can then funnel them into their broader, much more lucrative financial services, ecosystem mortgages, wealth advisory, private banking, and investments. This customer acquisition strategy is incredibly profitable in the long term, far beyond the annual fee itself.
And the high annual fee model is also highly lucrative for the banks because of a fascinating consumer paradox regarding utilization.
Many consumers pay the fees without actually utilizing all the offered perks, giving the banks incredibly high margins on what is essentially pure revenue. Furthermore, the fee hike strategy is partly designed to thin the herd of unprofitable customers. They want to discourage the cart hoppers, the consumers who meticulously maximize every single reward and switch frequently to Chase sign-up bonuses. The banks want the long-term, high-spending, high-margin customer, even if it means raising the barrier to entry significantly.
Now let's wrap up our deep dive by exploring the culture and personal pursuits that people are engaging in during this highly unusual, anxious, and exuberant moment.
We'll start with travel, specifically the Montafon Valley in Austria, which is a secret skiing destination. This valley has a remarkable, almost unique commitment to sustainable, small-scale tourism, deliberately resisting foreign investment in large-scale, high-end development for 50 years.
The valley prides itself on maintaining a delicate ecological and economic balance. They only grow tourism about 1% annually, have about 500 family-owned hotels, and have historically rebuffed investors who wanted to build an airport or large, glitzy hotels that would attract a completely different, wealthier clientele.
But this balance is now potentially under threat. Silvretta Montafon, one of the ski areas, has joined the Epic Pass. This is a massive, multi-mountain pass owned by Vail Resorts, a U.S. company. Locals are concerned that this move might disrupt the gentle ecosystem and fear the valley will be immediately overrun by a surge of international tourists unfamiliar with its ethos.
From mountains we ski down to mountains we climb up, we look at the psychological benefits of peak bagging.
This is a perfect example of focusing on mastery goals over performance goals. Instead of competing against others or achieving an arbitrary metric, peak bagging, like the monumental task of hiking all 214 Wainwright summits in England's Lake District, is about learning for learning's sake and achieving a defined personal objective.
And psychologically, the pursuit of mastery offers measurable benefits, which are vital in an anxious world.
It enhances overall well-being, improves self-esteem, provides a powerful sense of purpose, and is a great way to be deliberate about carving out dedicated time for a demanding hobby. Mastery goals, focusing on the process rather than the outcome compared to others, enhance life satisfaction and resilience. The sense of achievement, like the author finishing the 214 Wainwrights after nearly 9 years, brings a powerful mix of satisfaction and the quiet sadness that comes from completing a long road well-traveled.
And shifting to a more urban pursuit, we're seeing a boom in new, low-commitment wine bars in major cities like London and New York.
This is a direct, practical response to current economic pressures and changing consumer behavior. Wine bars are thriving because they are significantly less expensive to operate than high-end restaurants. They require leaner staffing. One co-owner noted his new wine bar needs 6 staff compared to 18 at his cozy full-service dining room. Lower overhead translates to lower prices for the consumer.
And they offer what consumers are craving in this financially strained moment, a low-commitment, flexible experience.
Exactly. As dining out gets exorbitantly expensive, you sneeze and spend $100 at a full service. Restaurant wine bars offer lower average customer spends and a chance for customers to direct things. You can have one glass or a bottle, a light snack, or an elaborate charcuterie board. It offers flexibility and casualness, meeting the consumer demand without the strictures of a prefix meal. It's an economically sustainable business model thriving in a high-anxiety environment.
Finally, we turn to culture with a look at Sir Anthony Hopkins' candid memoir, We Did Okay, Kid.
The memoir is an unflinching look at his spectacular career and his struggle with substance abuse, which he addresses with remarkable honesty.
Hopkins spoke candidly about his early life, admitting that his addiction, which he called jet fuel, was coupled with the fear and anger that paradoxically gave him a certain raw courage in his youth.
He looked back on his decades of heavy drinking and realized it was burning me up. His memoir is driven by profound gratitude for his eventual sobriety, which occurred 50 years ago. He reflects that his deeply dysfunctional early life somehow forced him to develop the intense focus and discipline that ultimately got him to where he is today.
His success led his father, who lived long enough to witness it, to ask him, "How the hell did you achieve this?" It's a powerful reflection on transformation, gratitude, and resilience from an 87-year-old still working and in good health.
And that truly brings us back to our central theme. Whether we're looking at investment decisions, is the AI boom a bubble, should I hold more cash, or governance with Trump's chaos and Newsom's aggressive counter-strategy, or even the environment trying to manipulate the weather through cloud seeding, the unifying theme is the attempt to gain control, whether through technology, political maneuvering, or personal mastery, in an increasingly volatile and unpredictable world.
It truly is. The most fascinating dynamic highlighted by these sources is the simultaneous presence of monumental risk and massive opportunity. We have the highest tariffs since the 1930s, yet global trade is showing surprising resilience. We have potentially bubble-level investment in AI, yet the underlying technology could transform the world in profound ways.
That tension is precisely where the smart money and the smart political actors are focusing their efforts. Yeah. They are hedging aggressively against the chaos while betting monumentally on the future.
And that leaves us with a final provocative thought to mull over. Given the significant strategic shift in global trade routes, the tariff crisis crippling key sectors in India, and China's deep entrenched port expansion network, how permanently has the political economy been reshaped by these new protectionist policies? Will the new alliances forged outside the U.S. and Asia, Europe, and Africa persist and solidify even if trade agreements change? Or have global supply chains irrevocably broken away from the U.S. gravitational pull for good?
An excellent question to consider as you navigate this ongoing feelings bubble.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into Bloomberg Business Week for November 2025. We'll see you next time.